and there she was, Clover, the woman his sister-in-law had met, the good match for him, the female whose interests were so similar to his own. They'd both been astonished to see the other. They both had laughed. The situation had to be explained. Then Clover had agreed to share a dinner with him after the drinks party. There, however, she'd put paid to the idea of the two of them acting on what was an obvious attraction between them. She said, before they even took up their menus, "This isn't going to lead to sex. I've gone that route before, but I've moved on from it. I thought it best to mention that at once, so we know where we stand with each other." She'd sounded so matter-of-fact about it that he'd been completely done in by what he'd seen as her breathtaking honesty, an honesty she'd held true to throughout their marriage. But now there was Gaz Ruddock to think about. Now there was the "we'll speak later" that Trevor had overheard, and he damn well could have had "we'll speak later" sorted a quarter hour after he'd heard those words, had he managed to keep his bloody wits about him, but he kept getting sidelined by his dick. He was in his office in Freeman Athletics thinking of this when his desk phone rang. He'd just decided to descend to the weight machines. There one of his trainers was in the act of getting friendly with a woman far too vulnerable to him. She'd lost 4 stone and was enough out of condition to make a young stud's advances welcome if he was subtle enough. Boyd was an expert at being subtle, and Trevor wasn't about to have that. The phone stopped him before he could make his move, though. He turned from the window and saw that it was his private line. Clover or Finn, he thought. But it was Gaz. He said, "I've tried getting through to Clo, but she's not answering her mobile and she's not in her office. Can you pass along a message to her, Trev?" Trevor instantly realized that an opportunity had fallen into his lap like a gift. He said, "Does the message concern what you and Clover plan to speak about later?" He didn't stop to consider how to frame the question more carefully. There was something of a silence before Gaz said, "Sorry?" "Last night," Trevor told him, "as you were leaving." Another silence, during which, Trevor reckoned, the wheels of Gaz's mind were probably turning to come up with something that would suffice as a reasonable excuse for what had been said. "Oh, that," came finally. "It was Scotland Yard. That's why I'm ringing. They've been here twice today, and I thought Clo would want to know." "So this isn't actually about what you plan to speak of later," Trevor pressed him. He wanted to pin the young man down. Clover might be nearly impossible to converse with when she had something she wished to hide, but the one thing that Gaz Ruddock wasn't was Clover Freeman. Gaz said, "Look, can I just say, mostly it's due to Finn. Clo asked me to, I suppose I'd call it to engage Finn in some way now that Ian Druitt's gone and there's no after-school club for Finn to volunteer at. Of course, there probably will be another club. I mean, eventually there will be, eh? But for now there's not. I mean, not till someone from the community takes over, or another deacon gets assigned to the St. Lawrence Church or whatever. So she's wondered how well Finn's going to do without something extra to occupy him." Trevor didn't like the idea of having an indirect sort of conversation with Gaz. He said, "I know all about your arrangement, Gaz." Gaz went for a show of confusion. "What arrangement's this?" "The one Clover set up last autumn, to have you look in on Finn and report back to her. So is that why you're ringing? Have you something to pass along about my son?" "Oh." Trevor heard the young man blow out a breath. It sounded like relief. "Not 100% exactly, but truth to tell you, it's good to hear that you know about what Clo asked me to do. I expect she told you last night. I could tell you knew something was going on."
"That I could, Gaz. Want to explain what else is going on?"
"I don't understand."
"I reckon you understand well enough. I'm curious about why you're ringing me instead of just leaving a message for my wife on her mobile. What's that about? Seems to me that it's about looking innocent."
"Of what? What do you want about, Trev?"
Trevor looked out of the window again. He saw that Boyd had now joined his middle-aged client on the bench for pressing weights. Both of them were straddling it, facing each other, legs spread. Christ. He needed to put a stop to what was going on inside Boyd's head, but at the moment he had something more important that he had to cope with. He said, his gaze still boring into Boyd's skull in order to get his attention, "What I'm on about is let's speak later. What I'm on about is getting to the truth, which I intend to get to before I pass any messages along to my wife."
"Trev," Gaz sounded like someone making an appeal, "I swear to God I don't know what you mean. I'm ringing because I reckon Clo would want to know that Scotland Yard were here to talk to me about Druitt, since there was a relationship between Druitt and Finn."
"What the hell? Gaz, do you want to tell me what's actually going on? It's just that since Chloe asked me to keep the eye on Finn, I thought, all things being equal...
He paused as if to gather courage, or to collect his thoughts. When he went on, he did so in something of a rush.
Trev, listen. Druitt rang me about Finn a few times, and I let Chloe know. I also told the two from Scotland Yard. I more or less had to, because they had his mobile, Druitt's, and they could see he rang me, and obviously they wanted to know why, and now they've taken mine as well, which is another reason why I'm ringing you.
Your mobile? What do they want with it?
They're checking everything.
And exactly what constitutes everything?
Turns out Chloe was using your mobile on occasion when she rang me about Finn. At least that's what I worked out when I saw how many calls came to me from your mobile, which I'd never noticed before. So what it is this.
There was another pause that did seem suspiciously like a working up of courage.
I ended up telling them, the Met detectives, that I'd been keeping an eye on Finn, and that you were the one who asked me to do it, and you were ringing me from your mobile to see how things were going. So now they'll be tracking you down, since your number will be in my mobile's records. I told them as much, but they're going to want to confirm. It's what they do. So what I'm hoping is you'll say you were the one asking me to watch Finn. Otherwise, Chloe gets put into the mix, and what's the point in that?
Protection was what this was all about, Trevor realized. And he read that hidden agenda like an article above the fold in a broadsheet. Protection of Clover was on Gaz's mind, and there was going to be a fascinating reason for that. But there was nothing to be gained by trying to delve for more information from the PCSO, so he gave lip service to going along with Gaz's request. But he didn't plan to do it without managing some kind of confrontation with his wife. Hindlip, Herefordshire. Prior to setting off for Hindlip, Trevor took a look at his mobile's history of calls made and calls received. He didn't know how long these intimate conversations between Clover and Gaz had been going on. That complete history was not available to him, but what he could see with just a glance was that six had occurred during the first visit of the Metropolitan Police, either late at night or during the early hours of the morning. Of course, he thought. His mobile would have been unavailable to her at any other time, unless he was charging it somewhere within her reach. When he arrived at the main building of the police headquarters, Trevor learned that Clover was not in her office, but rather at the training facility for the policing area's PCSOs. She was leading a discussion on the topic of options for community safety, her secretary told him. Did he want to walk over to the centre and catch the end of it, or would he rather wait here? Trevor said he'd listen in on the discussion Clover was leading. He knew where the training centre was. He set off at once. His choice of bearding her at work was deliberate. Clover was far too adept at misdirecting him, and he was far too weak when it came to the sort of misdirection she employed. Their discussion had to be on territory where she couldn't rely on her ability to trigger his animal nature. The training centre was beyond the chapel at the far end of the administration building. It was an institutional structure that offered an unappealing contrast to the older great house in which Clover, the chief constable, and the heads of various departments had their offices. Access to it required nothing more than opening the door. Once inside, it was a simple matter to find the hall in which the PCSOs in training were attending to the sage words of the officers on the panel at the front of the room. Trevor took up a position at the back of the hall, standing at the closed double doors with his head cocked in interest as he watched his wife. When she glanced in his direction, she did not react other than to curve her lips in the smallest of smiles. She was surprised, however, and never a fool. She would immediately know that something was up. She just wouldn't know what it was, since her presence here in the training session indicated why she'd been unavailable to Gaz. Even had she been within his reach, though, Trevor doubted that Gaz would have rung her even from a landline, as he wouldn't have wanted to risk further contact between them should he be intent upon protecting her. The meeting's conclusion released the PCSOs to depart for the day. Clover's fellow panelists exchanged a few words as they gathered up folders and other materials. Then they, too, were leaving, while Clover herself remained at the front of the room, stuffing her belongings into a briefcase. Trevor joined her and went straight to it. "You've been using my mobile to ring Gaz. I wouldn't have known, but he rang me. He's had to hand his phone over to the London detectives."
"Hello to you as well," she said. It was a surprise to look up and find my handsome husband listening. "How long have you been here? The subject must have bored you to tears."
"Gaz made a request. I thought best to run by you. He's asked me to confirm with the Met that I was the one who asked him to keep watch over Finn. He'd like me to say that the relevant phone calls to and from my phone dealt with my request and his subsequent reports as to Finn's activities. In other words, in case I'm not being completely clear,
He's asking me to lie. For him and, apparently, for you, since if I tell the London coppers I haven't a clue about a mass of phone calls to and from Gaz Ruddock on my mobile, they're going to want to know who else uses it. You're following me, Clover, aren't you? She ran a manicured fingernail along one of the seams of her briefcase. He wanted to force some kind of response, but when it came, it wasn't what he was looking for. I can see what you think. How clever she's been to use my mobile to arrange their trysts, or whatever you want to call them, since, really, when does someone check his own mobile to see what calls are going out from it, or coming into it, for that matter? We're heading to that, aren't we, with the image of me running my fingers over Gaz's lovely toned pectorals, the two of us all hot and bothered and ready for it in God knows whatever location we've managed to find. He was meant to deny that, but he saw that the issue of we'll speak later, which he'd intended to bring up with her, was going to end up becoming another way to avoid a different sort of conversation. Instead of what was actually going on, and this appeared to have Finn sitting directly at the centre of it, he was intended to snatch at the image she'd presented to him, his mind arrested by the image's correlation to what he'd overheard. He was then intended to be led by the nose into making that the subject of an ensuing discussion. It was a vintage Clover Freeman move. If you share Gez's hope that I'll lie to the police, should they show up again on our doorstep, Clover, then you'll need to complete the picture of what's going on, because that's what it's going to take. She was silent again as somewhere outside dogs began barking. Dinner time, he reckoned. She finally said, All right. Here it is. I'll make it bald, as I presume you want the facts as plainly and simply stated as I can make them. You're right about that. Fine. Ian Druitt had some concerns about Finnegan. They developed over time, and he finally rang Gaz to talk them over, as he knew Gaz and Finnegan were friendly.
What sort of concerns?
The kind that begin with, he's a nice enough boy, but I'm worried that I'm seeing something I ought not to be seeing. Gaz rang me once Druitt spoke to him. It was a question of what we were going to do about it.
About what?
Stop dancing round this, Clover. You said you were going to make it bald, so do it. Finnegan and drink. Finnegan and marijuana. Finnegan and his rather salty language, and Finnegan not behaving round the children quite as he ought to have been behaving.
What the hell is that supposed to mean? Are you saying that Finn was...
What? Supplying children with beer and wine? Selling them weed? Leading them astray by... The implication took his breath away.
Wait. Was Finn supposedly doing something to those children? Is that what you're telling me?
I don't know what I'm telling you. I'm giving you the information I was given. You wanted to know, so I'm letting you know.
I don't bloody believe it.
Neither did I.
Did? Not do?
Stop playing with words. I'm telling you what Druitt was concerned about. I'm telling you why Gaz and I rang each other. He was tasked, by me, with keeping an eye on Finnegan, and now here was this suggestion on the part of Druitt that Finnegan was misbehaving in a way that could get him into the kind of trouble that could haunt him for the rest of his life, no matter what it was. Drink, drugs, sexual misconduct. I didn't know. I still don't know. But what I did know was that I couldn't have that happen. Finnegan in trouble. And I especially couldn't have that happen, as I was the one who put Finnegan into the position of being round those children in the first place. As far as I was concerned, as far as I am concerned, what actually happened is that Finnegan witnessed something between Druitt and a child, that Druitt realized this and made a preemptive strike. He turned in Finnegan to Gaz before Finnegan could do the same to him.
And then what?
Then Gaz told me. I wanted Finnegan away from Druitt as quickly as possible. But bloody-minded as he's ever been, Finnegan refused to leave the children. Can you see how that looks? He said he was helping them. He liked Druitt. He even got to show off his karate skills, and on and on. So he had to be told at least part of the truth, which, Finnegan being Finnegan, he did not for an instant believe.
Which part of the truth?
Just that Druitt had spoken to Gaz about having some concerns how Finnegan was interacting with the children. I kept it vague because it needed to be vague.
Why would that be, Clover? Why not tell him what was going on so that he could at least defend himself?
Listen to your own words, for heaven's sake. Think about what goes for defending himself when it comes to Finnegan. I was worried that he might lose his temper. He might act out in a way that could result in trouble for him.
So you must have been thinking...
I wasn't thinking anything but getting our son away from Ian Druitt and his after-school club. But then Druitt won some bloody award, and a phone call was made anonymously accusing Druitt of child molestation, and,
my God, you think Finn made that call, don't you? Getting his own after Druitt spoke to Gaz.
I don't think anything. I don't know anything. But when I finally heard about that call to 999, it was something that couldn't be ignored, so Druitt had to be brought in for questioning. Trevor took this last bit in with a growing sense of horror. Puzzle pieces began to fit together in ways he did not dream he would ever have to look upon. He forced himself to say, "So Druitt had to be eliminated." She grasped her throat.
"What in God's name do you take me for? Of course he didn't need to be eliminated, but whatever was going on in that club had to be looked at, because if it wasn't, Finnegan was going to be looked at. You know how he is and how he reacts and how simple it is to trigger his temper. When his temper goes, he's nothing but reaction incarnate, completely devoid of the ability to think. I didn't want to put him in that position then, and I don't want to put him in that position now. I can't take that chance."
She lifted her briefcase from the table at which the panel had been sitting. He could see that, as far as she was concerned, their conversation had reached its conclusion. But not for him. He said, "Exactly what the hell does that mean? You can't take the chance."
"I don't want the Met talking to him. I don't want them even looking at him. Not because he's done anything at all, but because..."
"He'll think you set them on him." Trevor felt staggered by what she was saying about truth and lies and crime and its aftermath.
"Christ, Clover! This isn't about what Finn thinks of you. Don't you see that? This is about a possible crime. If Finn did nothing to anyone, he has nothing to worry about. You can't possibly be that naive."
She stalked up the aisle towards the doors to the hall. When she reached the exit, she spun back to him.
"You haven't the first idea how the police work, so let me enlighten you. If they speak with Finnegan and he says anything to pique their interest, they will not let up. They'll move from Druitt's concerns about him directly to Druitt's suicide, and they'll be on their way to deciding it wasn't suicide at all. It was murder, and he is their suspect, because he has motive. And from there it's a hop and skip to his having opportunity. Do you understand that, Trevor?"
"You believe he's done that as well?" Trevor could scarcely get the words out, so aghast he was at Clover's thinking. "You believe that Finn—"
"I don't believe anything," she said. "I don't have all the facts. I never had them. All I know is what was said, the back and forth of it all. All I ever knew was that Finnegan spent time with those children. So will you just look at the larger implications here? I'm his mother, for the love of God, and my first job in life is to be his mother. Everything else falls into line, but that line forms after Finnegan's well-being. And nothing, Treff, takes precedence over that."
He let that one weigh down the air for a bit. He strode up the aisle to join her by the exit. He removed his mobile from his pocket as he walked. He gestured with it as he said, "Just to be certain I'm on board with everything, you want me to lie to the police as well, should they come calling on me about Gaz's mobile and my own? You and he expect me to tell those detectives that Gaz and I were speaking about child-minding Finn, about my request that Finn be child-minded, and his reports on how the child-minding was going. Would that be how it is, Clover?" She didn't reply, although her face was fixed enough to give him her answer. He said, "You two must be thick as planks to think the Met are going to swallow that and walk away without having a word with Finn."
"Then tell them what you wish," she replied. "Tell them everything I've just told you. Tell them my objective, to keep Finnegan from ruining his life through his own bloody-mindedness, and then start praying that when they go to speak with him, he'll be able to hold his own against them."
19th May. Ludlow, Shropshire. Ding had briefly considered skipping her appointment with the college counsellor, because she couldn't see that anything positive might come from it. The truth was, she'd completely lost the will to haul herself to her lectures, and when it came to her tutorials, she'd been hit and miss for ages. Her tutor had tracked her down several times. The poor man had even attempted his version of reading her the riot act. So, really, it was no surprise that Greta Yates had now insisted on an intimate little chat. The only real surprise was that it had taken the counsellor so long to get round to giving Ding the order. Thus Ding made her way up to Castle Square campus at the appropriate time. She hadn't slept well, but that was how things were now. She did the job with Finn, shared a spliff afterwards, tossed him out of her room, locked her door against his,
"Hey, don't be that way!"
when he expected a thanks for the weed in the form of letting him spray her tonsils again, and then hoped for sleep. It finally arrived, but on a train so slow, it was after 3 a.m. before the voices in her head stopped shouting and allowed her a respite in the form of restless dreams. Greta Yates turned out to be a ginormous woman with a chesty way of breathing and a voice that suggested she wasn't able to get enough oxygen.
The trip from her office door, where she'd called out Ding's name into the waiting area, back to her desk chair, brought enough blood to her face that Ding feared the woman would start bleeding from her eyeballs. She sank into her chair, then pulled a box of tissues from a drawer in her desk. This she plopped onto a stack of folders so tall that Ding wondered what they represented, her workload or a lack of organizational skills. The tissues turned out to be for Miss Yates's use. She blotted her face with two of them and blew her nose on a third. Then she folded her hands, displaying a huge emerald ring that was either totally phony or a testimony to serious family wealth, and she favored Ding with a look over. Her first words stated the conclusion she'd reached.
"Parties, pubs, or a boyfriend. I've seen that you don't live at home. Have you lived away from your parents before now?"
The mention of parents in the plural grounded Ding in an excuse. While it wasn't the truth, it also wasn't a lie, and it took absolutely no effort on her part to summon tears when she spoke of it. "It was her dad," she said. She felt her chin quivering. "It was an accident," she said. "It happened at home. They had a putrid, petrified wreck of a house near Much Wenlock, and all of them were meant to work on making it livable for the family. She herself went home at the weekends to help with the project. The wiring was being replaced, and her dad was upstairs." A long hesitation, she found, was the very thing to build not only suspense, but the dread of being fairly certain what was to come. "It was the electricity," Ding said, because although she knew the story was false without knowing why she knew the story was false, it remained the fiction that her mum clung to just as she had done the first time, when Ding had recovered enough to say, "But, Mummy, what was he doing?" Miss Yates was all sympathy at once. She was all,
"I'm very sorry. When did this happen? Why wasn't your tutor advised?"
It had happened 14 years in the past, but Ding could hardly tell her that. So she said,
"Round Easter. Have you spoken to anyone about it?"
Ding shook her head.
"We keep things rather close, my family. But you surely can see from what's happened with your performance here at the college that you mustn't hold these things inside."
She did see that, Ding told her. But it was too difficult at present. It felt so raw. She simply could not speak of it. But she knew she had to, because obviously she wasn't coping well, and her work at the college was showing this. She understood that. She really did.
"You know why I'm here," Greta Yates said. "If you need to talk, please do stop by."
Considering everything on the woman's desk, Ding couldn't see how Miss Yates would have time to do anything but give cursory comfort, cursory advice, or cursory warnings about the consequences of one's failure to attend lectures and tutorials. And what did it matter anyway, because everyone lied, including herself, and as a result there was no comfort available anywhere. So Ding thanked the counsellor and explained that, while she had been in a terrible funk, she was coming out of it. She could feel the difference in her. She thought it had to do with the arrival of spring, and what spring meant, hope, rebirth, rejuvenation, blah, blah, blah.
"Will you be able to get back to your studies?" Miss Yates asked.
Her voice was warm enough, but it still managed to be monitory. "Yes," Ding told her. Dina Donaldson would now be able to get back to her studies. Miss Yates could expect that without a doubt.
"Sometimes," Ding said, "it's still difficult, but I do think I'm through the very worst of it."
And she wanted to believe her own declaration, even as she knew it was just another lie. Ludlow, Shropshire. Rather than stopping immediately in Teamside when they left the hotel, Havers directed Linley back to the police station first. She had something she wanted him to see, she told him. When he had the car in gear, she directed him first to Broad Street, where they dropped down to the river. From there they cruised east to Teamside till they came to Weeping Cross Lane. A left turn, and they were less than 1 minute by car from the Nick. She pointed out that the businesses along the route were set back far enough from the road that no one driving, biking, walking, rollerblading or hopping along on a pop stick would be caught doing so by a CCTV camera on a building.
"In other words," she concluded as Linley pulled into Townsend Close, "you've got a nice quick route from the house where Finnegan Freeman lives. I made the walk myself, sir. I reckoned then, and I reckon now, it's an interesting detail."
"It's even more interesting now we know what Ruddock was up to in the car park when Druitt died.
It would have been a simple matter for someone to get to the station using that route. No one would think twice if they saw someone walking or biking in that street. It leads up to town. It leads to the rail station. It leads to Tesco. You name it, sir. and it would have been another simple matter to get past the patrol car, unseen, and into the station. Then it would have been a short stroll down the corridor to the office where Druitt was stowed.
Linley followed the direction of her gaze, which was on the station's car park. "Let's learn what's what with Finnegan Freeman," was his conclusion, to which he added, "And there's something else we might want to toss round."
"What's that, sir?"
"DCC Freeman and Ruddock." Linley reversed, and they returned to Lower Golderford. They cruised back along Weeping Cross Lane and from there to the river. If Trevor Freeman feels he can make a request of Ruddock involving Finnegan, then Ruddock obviously knows Trevor well. Why not the DCC in addition to Trevor? And perhaps those two know each other well enough to get up to unofficial business together.
"I can see them as lovers," Havers said. "She's got to be less than 20 years older than he is, and those years don't count for much when you're as fit as she is, which makes rolling round naked with a young PCSO something we can't cross off the list. She could be using the husband's phone to set things up."
"As you say, nothing can be discounted." They reached the home where Finnegan Freeman lived, a very short distance from Weeping Cross Lane. They parked farther along and mostly on the pavement before walking back to the house, where they rapped on the door, then rang the bell. The door was opened by a young man dressed so dapperly that he looked like a model for menswear. He was accompanied by a girl with mounds of tumbling dark hair. Their fingers were twined together as if their intention had been to leave the house and not to answer the door. That indeed turned out to be the case. He said,
"Oh, sorry, can I help you? We were just heading out."
Linley showed his identification and introduced Havers. Before he could explain why they'd come, the boy said,
"You lot must want Finn."
"Why do you say that?" Linley asked him.
"'Cause if there are coppers at the door, fact is they don't ever want anyone else."
"And you are?"
"Bruce Castle," he told them. "I live here as well. This is Monica." "Jordan," she added.
"She doesn't live here," Castle said.
"Come inside, I'll see about Finn."
He left the door gaping open and walked to the foot of a stairway close by, yelling, "Freeman! You're wanted by the filth again!" Then he said to Linley, with an apologetic shrug of his shoulders,
"Sorry, slipped out. Too much telly."
And then once more in the direction of the upper floor,
"Freeman! Pull it out of her and get down here, wanker!"
Which caused his companion Monica to giggle nervously. No answer to Bruce Castle's shouts. Finn Freeman was either comatose or not at home. Castle turned to them and said,
"You lot want me to, I don't know, tell Finn he's wanted? Have him ring you? Let you know if he shows his face?"
Linley took out a card and handed it over. Havers did the same for good measure. Castle shoved the cards into the breast pocket of his tailored shirt and told them they could always wait if they wished, or they could come back. They could even surprise Finn if they had a mind to.
"Doors never locked," he informed them with a casual shrug, "so have at him if you want. Morning's generally best. The earlier the better."
Then he was off, towing Monica along, leaving the door gaping open behind them.
"We could turn over the furniture," Havers said.
When she glanced into the sitting room, she added,
"Such as it is,
which it isn't."
"Bloody hell. How do people live like this? This place is a rubbish tip."
"It's the resiliency of youth," Linley answered. "We'll come back. As Mr. Castle just informed us, I expect early morning we'll do the trick." They shut the front door behind them. As Havers headed to the street, Linley checked to see if Bruce Castle had spoken the truth. He had done. The door was easily opened. That was to their advantage if they wanted to rouse Finnegan Freeman at dawn. Ludlow, Shropshire. Ding was trudging along Teamside with a house in sight when she saw Brutus. She didn't know the name of the girl who accompanied him, but she could tell by her expression that she was yet another of Brutus's mindless conquests. Ding found, oddly, that she wasn't bothered. Put up against having to face Greta Yates and experiencing yet another round of having to manufacture believable tales, Brutus leaving the house with whoever she was traipsing along behind him didn't seem to matter. Brutus, remaining true to form, of course, thought she was going to care mightily. He, of course, thought she was going to cause a scene. Ding couldn't blame him, as that had been their routine, but instead of the usual, she said to him,
"Just tell me Finn has actually gone to a lecture for once and I'll be happy."
Before he could reply, she said to the girl with him,
"I'm Dina. Ding, actually. I've got the room next door to Brutus."
"Monica,"
the girl said, with quite a pretty smile. She'd worn braces. Her teeth were way too seriously perfect. It was clear that Brutus didn't quite know what to make of this. He said, "You just getting home, Ding?" And his tone was suspicious, as if what he thought was that this was yet another game in which Dina Donaldson made yet another ridiculous attempt to stimulate him to raging jealousy. She said, "Had to have a chat with a counsellor." She ran her hand through her hair, which she realized she'd not brushed before leaving the house earlier. "I'm knackered. I need some sleep. Tell me no one's home." "No one's home," he said.
"Except the police, Brute," Monica said. "They're still inside."
She looked over her shoulder and added,
"Oh, there they are. I guess they decided not to wait."
"More cops wanting a word with Finn," Brutus told Ding. He peered at her closely, as if attempting to read her in an entirely new way. "You sure you're okay?" She was, Ding thought, more or less. One thing was certain, though, she did not want coppers to be part of her day. There were two of them. A blondish man dressed the way she expected Brutus would have dressed if he were 10 inches taller and 20 years older, and a rumpled-looking woman with short, shaggy hair that appeared as uncombed and unbrushed as Ding's hair was. She said to Brutus,
"Who are they, then?"
And he removed 2 cards from his pocket and handed them to her. "You can give these to Finn when you see him. No clue what they want to talk to him about, but it's probably Druid again, since that's what it was last time." Ding looked at the card and took in the fact that the 2 officers were detectives, and that once again someone from London had been sent to Ludlow. She said to Brutus,
"If I see Finn, I'll tell him."
"Why wouldn't you see him?" Brutus sounded suspicious. "How odd," she thought. "He still thinks I'm playing a game." She said to him,
"Just now, I don't much feel like seeing anyone. Nice to meet you, Monica."
Which, really, was all she wanted to say. She saw that the cops were looking her way. She reckoned they caught sight of Brutus handing over their cards to her. That would mean a deduction on their part that she was also someone who knew Finn Freeman and was thus worth talking to. But she didn't want to talk to cops. She'd managed not to the first time they'd been in Ludlow, and she intended to manage not to this time round as well. She was considering the best way to avoid them when her circumstances underwent an alteration. For just as she was about to head in the direction of Lower Broad Street with a pretense of sauntering to a lecture at the college, which would take her away from the position the cops had adopted on the pavement as if waiting for her, Rabia Lomax not only drove by, but she also honked. She gave Ding a signal with her hand that unmistakably telegraphed, "Wait right there." She parked not far from the weir, got out and called, "Dina Donaldson, I want a word," which of course got the cops' attention. They looked over to where Mrs. Lomax was slamming shut her car door. Then they looked from Mrs. Lomax to Ding. Then they looked at each other. None of this, Ding reckoned, was going to do her the least bit of good. Ludlow, Shropshire. Rabia saw the Scotland Yard detectives a moment after she called out to Ding. She didn't have time to develop any theories about what they were doing at the building where Ding lived, or about what they might conclude, seeing Rabia Lomax in the same location. The only activity that she had time or the inclination to engage in was whatever activity it was going to take to keep Dina Donaldson from doing a runner. That she wanted to was clear. She gave a quick glance round and half a turn in the direction of the Ludford Bridge. She called,
"You and I need to have a talk, Ding. Come here at once. And as for you two,"
this she added towards the 2 detectives who were already crossing the street in her direction, "I've got no time to have another confab with the Met. My attorney is called Aeschylus Kong. He's in the directory. Ring him and ask for an appointment if we need to speak to each other again." Ding hung back. The detectives did not. When they reached her, Rabia said, "What is it about having family difficulties that you lot don't understand?" And then, "Ding, you heard me. Go into the house and I'll be there presently. Do not even think about doing a runner. I can chase you down and am happy to do it." Ding apparently took her seriously, as well she might, since she knew Rabia was a marathon winner, while Ding herself probably wouldn't have made it 100 yards without needing to catch her breath. So she grabbed at the chance to scurry to the house, looking neither at Rabia nor at the cops. The male, Rabia remembered his name, Linley, said to her, "This won't take longer than 1 or 2 minutes, Mrs. Lomax." The female, God, what was her name, said,
"We've got Ian Druitt's mobile, Mrs. Lomax. You had 7 appointments with him, but there's not a single call to or from you on his mobile's records."
"What about it?" she snapped. "Do you not see I've no time for this rubbish?"
"It seems you would have needed to arrange your appointments," Linley said.
"Will you tell us how you managed that, without ringing him?"
"Oh, don't be absurd," she said. "I have no idea what number I rang to speak with him. For all I know, I rang the vicarage. I didn't have any other number, least of all his mobiles."
"Are you saying—"
"What I'm saying is that I have a family situation I'm dealing with at present, so I've more important things to do than providing you with instant answers to whatever questions you decide to ask me. Now, as I said, he's called Aeschylus Kong. Your sergeant here has already met him."
That said, she left them and plunged across the street, where she strode to Ding's front door and didn't bother with the bell or knocking. She found the girl in what went for the sitting room, which was sparsely furnished and looked as if it hadn't been hoovered, dusted, or had its uneaten crusts of pizza, empty yogurt cartons, and balled-up crisp packets removed since the beginning of autumn term. It also smelled disgustingly of boys' shoes and underwear. Rubia couldn't begin to comprehend how Ding lived in such a place. The girl was sitting on a chintz sofa that was stained with substances that Rubia didn't wish to identify. She had her knees together and her legs splayed out from them at angles. She looked like a schoolgirl who knew very well she was in for a dressing down.
"Just what the bloody hell is going on?" Rubia demanded. "That's what I want to know, and that's what you're going to tell me. I've spoken to Missa."
Ding touched her upper lip with her tongue.
"Oh, is this to do with Missa?" "You know damn well it's to do with Missa. So let me repeat the initial question. What the bloody hell is going on?"
Ding shook her head, her expression perplexed.
"Really, Mrs. Lomax? I don't know what you mean. Then let me clarify. I've got cops sniffing round my family. Missa claims that the reason for this is spelled D-E-N-A. I didn't hand you over to them just now because I want to get to the truth. Either Missa is lying or you're lying, or you both are lying. In any case, we've reached the finish line when it comes to all that. Do you want to talk to me or to them? Make up your mind before I lose patience with you."
Ding placed one of her hands flat on the filthy sofa. The other she kept balled in her lap. She said,
"What are we supposed to be lying about?" "The deacon. The one who died. He had our surname in his diary, and that's proving quite titillating for the police." "Is that why they know you? Don't try to misdirect me. You had 7 meetings with him. You used our name. We're going to talk about that, and then you're going to tell the police, who will exit stage left from my life." "No way," Ding said. "Don't argue with me. Just take a moment to thank God I didn't turn you over to them 3 minutes ago." "I didn't mean... Mrs. Lomax, I never used your name for anything. I never talked to the deacon. I didn't even know who he was. If Missa told you that..."
The girl didn't seem to want to finish the sentence. Rabia did it for her.
"Missa lied," she said. "Is that what you wish to tell me? And exactly what bloody reason would she have for lying?" "I don't know. I don't even know why she was talking to him. Don't you take me for a fool. I know something about friendship between women, and what I know is that very good friends, let's go as far as to call them best friends, do not have secrets from each other. What I also know is that you and my granddaughter were best friends, and then all of a sudden she wanted to leave Ludlow, and that was that. And now I discover that she might have had a very good reason for wanting to leave, with that reason sitting in this room, guilty of using our surname in God knows what scheme that she had going on." "That isn't true," Ding protested. "I never did anything. And I keep getting accused. And I don't know..."
Unaccountably, she began to weep.
"Nothing works. And now there's Monica. Every single night he keeps wanting more, and it's like I can't ever stop, even if I want to."
Rabia knew hysteria when she saw it. She said,
"Good Lord, child, what's happening here?" "You talk to Missa if you want to know," Ding cried. "If anyone's lying about anything, it's her."
Ludlow, Shropshire. Barbara Havers did not want to get anything wrong, so she hesitated once they'd exchanged words with Rabia Lomax. She knew she had to take massive care in how she relayed her information to Linley, because she wasn't entirely certain it was accurate. Linley wouldn't act hastily once he heard what she had to say. He never did that. But the fact remained that one false move on their part might put the wind up. When Linley said, "There's another coincidence for you, Sergeant," she replied with,
"What's that, sir?"
He looked rather surprised that she needed to ask, saying, "Do you find it at all odd that Rabia Lomax has just turned up at the home of Finnegan Freeman?" She said,
"Oh, that."
"What do you expect it's about? She's not there to sign him up for scouting, I dare say."
"What I reckon is that we've got too many bloody coincidences at this point for them to be coincidences."
"I don't disagree."
"She wants talking to again."
"Hmm. Yes. Although since she's now hauling in her solicitor, I doubt we'll manage much information from her. Did you hear what she said to the girl? Barbara nodded. He'd given her the entree she needed, so she decided to use it.
As to that, sir, there's something else.
Since they'd been nearly across the street when they'd accosted Rabia Lomax, they'd walked the rest of the way to the river and were looking over the water at a family of swans, which allowed Barbara to access her players and light up. Lindley automatically moved upwind. She sucked in some smoke.
That girl Mrs. Lomax was talking to? Dina Donaldson, right? She called her Ding? I'm not 100% on this, because it's been 10 days or so and it was dark. But that girl, Ding...
What about her, aside from the name? It reminds me vaguely of my mother's, by the way. Her name is Dorothy, but she's always been called Days. I've never thought to ask why.
Why would you, since you call her Mummy, or Mother, or Mater, or whatever you lot call your Madras? Anyway, that girl Ding, I think I've seen her before.
Hardly earthquake material, Sergeant. Ludlow's centre not being particularly large. Unless, of course, it's the where and when of seeing her that's the important bit. Where was it?
In the car park behind the police station.
Linley turned his gaze from the river to her. Indeed?
She was the one who got out of Gary Ruddock's patrol car, sir. It was at night, so, like I said, I can't be 100% on this, but she sure as hell looks like her.
Linley gazed from Barbara to the house into which the girl and Rabia Lomax had disappeared. His expression was speculative. Barbara warmed to her topic.
He's gone wobbly whenever it comes to the women in his life, Inspector. First he told me he doesn't have a woman. Then he tells us he does, but she's married, and he's more or less love-bound or whatever to protect her. And now there's this girl. And we see her going into a house, presumably where she lives, which is also the house where Finnegan Freeman lives, which is also the house that sits seriously near a quick route to the police station. And that smells like 3-day-old fish, wouldn't you say?
It's certainly not fragrant, Linley noted. He went on to point out, however, as you said, it was night when you caught a glimpse of her.
And it was shadowy where he'd parked. I'll give you that, so I could be mistaken. But when she got out of the car, the light inside it went on, as per usual. Then he got out. He said a few words, then she got back in. It was like first she decided to give him the romantic heave-ho, but then he said something that made her reconsider. So she climbed back in, and he did as well, and the rest is whatever they got up to after that.
The question, Linley said, is whether Ruddock is lying about the married woman or whether he's having more than one relationship. In either case, the fact that he told you from the start that he had no one in his life... How did that come up, Sergeant? Barbara thought back to recapture the moment. She said,
A tattoo. It's uppercase C-A-T for Catherine. I asked him was he an animal lover, but he said Cat was his mum, and he'd grown up in some dodgy cult in Ireland, where the babies got taken early from their mums and they lived totally separate from them, so they had to have tattoos, so the boy babies didn't have sex with their own mums later on, or with their sisters. It gave me the shivers, that story. Perhaps I should have checked it out, but I reckoned I needed to do, well, whatever the gov told me, you know.
Linley seemed to take all of this in with an unexpected lack of surprise. He turned from the river, crossed his arms, and leaned against the wall that separated them from one of the weirs. He said, Poor Oedipus. Had he only had the same, it would have saved him from so much trouble. But, of course, they thought they'd dispatched him, didn't they? Barbara was used to his literary and historical musings. She let this one pass. She dropped her cigarette to the ground and put it out with her shoe. He eyed it, eyed her, and she sighed. She picked up the dog end and stripped it, allowing the unsmoked flakes of tobacco to float away on the breeze.
"What I'm thinking is this," she said to him.
When he nodded, she went on.
If the PCSO is involved with that girl, then someone besides the girl herself and the PCSO is going to know it.
How do you arrive at that? Linley asked her.
The simplest way, sir. If I saw them together, someone else has to have seen them together as well. At some time. In some place. We just need to find that person. Another good idea where to look.
Blist Hill, Victorian Town, Shropshire. Since motorways had never sliced a hideous incision into the Shropshire countryside, there were very few direct routes to anywhere. And that was certainly the case with the route to Blist Hill, Victorian Town. The place lay just west of Ironbridge, which itself had been built along the River Severn, leaving it unfortunately exposed to the river's periodic flooding. Bliss's Hill, on the other hand, stood at a much higher elevation, reached through a thick woodland of oaks, chestnuts, and sycamores that unfurled their fresh spring leaves in such a way that sunlight dappled the road. The inspiration of an enterprising individual who had seen a unique use for brick blast furnaces, an abandoned mine shaft, and an ingenious inclined plane that had once lifted boats from the river to the Shropshire Canal, Bliss's Hill had been created as a tourist attraction and an educational centre. It featured an entire town circa 1900. It was here that Rabea drove once she left Ding in Teamside. She hadn't been to the place in years, and on her arrival she saw from the crowded conditions in the car park that it hadn't lost its popularity as a destination for day-trippers and pensioners, as well as an opportunity for schoolchildren to see in person what their teachers droned on about at the front of their classrooms. Rabea joined the queue to purchase a ticket. While she could have phoned ahead and arranged for her granddaughter to meet her and sign her onto the property as a guest, she wished for the element of surprise, so she handed over the exorbitant amount required. Had they never heard of decent concessions for pensioners, she wondered, and she accepted a street plan of the place, although she didn't actually need one. Rabea knew where to find Missa. She'd heard from the girl's mother instantly once Missa had informed her that, despite having been talked into giving West Mercia College another chance after the Christmas holiday, she'd made her final decision and was adamant about it. College and uni were not for her. "She's decided candle-making is a fine career," Yasmina had declared bitterly over the phone. "Can you not talk some sense into her, Mum?" At least it was a step up from the fish-and-chips shop, Rabea had wanted to point out, but a light-hearted response would not have been helpful in the situation. So Rabea had attempted to reassure her daughter-in-law that all young people went through stages, and this, no doubt, was one of them. But Yasmina hadn't believed that for a moment, and Rabea could not fault her for this, since Yasmina herself had never gone through a single stage, other than the one that had taken her to her goal of practicing paediatric medicine. While it was true that an unplanned pregnancy had slowed her progress, that was all it had done. So for Yasmina's own daughter to eschew a formal education in favour of a life dipping wicks into tallow was inconceivable. "Something's happened to her thinking," Yasmina had told her. "She says it has nothing to do with Justin, but I don't believe her. He's brought her back here somehow. He's said something. He's done something. He's threatened to—oh, I don't know. Please talk some sense into her, Mum, because Timothy and I have tried, and we've got nowhere." Rabea had done her part, but it had come to nothing. At the time, though, she'd had little knowledge at her fingertips. Now, at least, she had Missa's claim versus Ding's claim, and the certainty that something was being hidden from her. Since Bliss's Hill featured demonstrations of late Victorian life in a factory town, various craftspeople plied their trades in purpose-built locations. Hence the streets accommodated tinsmiths, harness makers, ironworkers, and blacksmiths, as well as grocers, bakers, butchers, and bankers, all in suitable buildings. Among them was the candlemaker's shop, at the midway point of the main thoroughfare. The shop was illuminated only by sunlight coming from two windows and the open door. When Rabea entered, she became one of 10 observers who were listening to Missa's explanation of the process. It looked deadly tedious, the sort of activity that Rabea would have lasted 1 8-hour workday doing. The attachment of long wicks to narrow dipping boards, the immersing of those wicks into a rectangular vat of tallow, the wait for the wicks to dry, the second, third, fourth, and what had to be 1,000th dipping in order to build up tallow on the wick to have enough to burn. If there was a more boring activity on the face of the planet, Rabea could not have said what it might be. She worked her way into a position from which she would be seen once Missa looked up from her work. Her granddaughter was garbed in a cotton gown of the period, which was covered by a heavy pinafore apron to protect her costume from dripping wax. She was explaining to the observers that the candlemaker's job was generally done by a man, since most women of the period would have been teachers or shop assistants or wives and mums. When one of the watching children said, "Miss, can I ask you a question?" Missa looked up and saw Rabea. Rabea was relieved to be greeted with a delighted smile. She pointed to her watch and made a movement that simulated having a cup of tea, and her granddaughter nodded. Rabea took heart from this. Instead of the refreshment pavilion, though, Rabea went first to the blacksmith's shop. There she saw that Justin Goodale, Missa's long-time boyfriend, was completing a demonstration of horseshoe-making. There wasn't a horse present to be shooed, but there was a roaring fire inside the forge, as well as all the tools needed to make just about anything out of the pieces of iron that lay about the smithy. Some items, she saw, had already been fashioned. In addition to horseshoes, the business ends of rakes, hoes, shovels, and pitchforks sat in display cases and hung from the wall. Additionally, iron hooks of various sizes formed a jumbled pile upon the floor. Rebia waited as Justin's small audience moved off to another location. He saw her then and said hello over the noise from the forge. Like Missa, he looked quite pleased to see her.
"I'm having a break."
He removed his heavy leather apron and a pair of anachronistic safety glasses. His flannel shirt bore perspiration rings, and his face was damp with sweat. Rivulets of this ran from his forehead, down his cheeks, and into his neatly trimmed beard. He removed a kerchief from his pocket and wiped his face. He'd always been a nice-looking boy, Rabia thought, and he'd grown into a very handsome young man. He had a wealth of beautiful chestnut hair that he wore long and tied back, perhaps in the fashion of a Victorian-era blacksmith. His brown eyes were deeply dark and soulful, and his expression was utterly appealing. He was big and burly, as one would expect of a blacksmith, with muscular arms and a broad chest. She imagined the local girl found him quite swoon-worthy. She said, "If it's your break, can an old lady buy you a cup of tea?"
"No old lady round here that I can see," was his reply. "But if the handsome woman talking to me would like to treat me to a cuppa, I wouldn't say no."
"Flatterer," she said. "You must be negotiating for a scone as well."
"I was thinking cake," he admitted.
She laughed as he joined her. He was careful about seeing to it that the smithy was secured, and he offered her his arm in a gentlemanly fashion as they walked to the refreshment pavilion. It sat just opposite a Victorian fairground, and once they'd secured their tea and a slice of lemon sponge for Justin, they found a table within viewing distance of the stalls serving as games of chance, where, for a Victorian tuppence, children could try their luck in order to win sweets, muslin bags of marbles, and garishly painted figures rendered in plaster. "So," Rabia lifted her cup of tea, "are you pleased to have Missa home again?"
"I am that,"
Justin dug into his cake. "It must be nice for you, then, having her put away college and uni for a simpler life."
"I was never against her going to uni," he said with a glance at her. "Whatever Missa wants is what I want for her, but I won't lie. I am that glad she's given it up. She wanted to be back in December, you know, but she got talked out of it by her mum."
"Yasmina told me at the time," Rabia said. "To be honest, none of us were ever sure why she wanted to give up on it."
"She told me she couldn't cope with a science course. I suppose it's difficult for some people, eh? But a science course is no real matter to her future, is it? I'll be supporting us, and they'll be our kids, and she'll want to be at home with them anyway."
"You two have plans, then?" Rabia noted. "Miss has not told me. Do her parents know?"
"What?"
"The plans. You, Missa, children?"
"Oh. Well, not yet. I mean, we've been together so long, me and Missa, that her mum and dad won't be surprised, will they? Meantime, I've got more saving to do. I mean us to have our own place. Not before we marry, of course. We wouldn't do that. Missa would never. Well, she's not one for that sort of thing. Before marriage, I mean. Her mum's made sure. Not that I think it's a bad thing, mind you. Not to, I mean. But Yasmina, Dr. Lomax, told her about it all. You probably know that, eh? So Missus always said there won't be any of it till afterwards."
Rabia took a moment to sort through this. Justin was an open book, but he often communicated in ways that only he understood. She said, to clarify, "You mean no sex before marriage because of what happened to Yasmina and my Tim?" Justin squirmed a bit and shot her a glance.
"Missus says the wedding night's meant to be special. She says a white wedding is a white wedding. I've got to respect that, don't I?"
He squinted in the sunlight and directed his attention to a young couple passing by, their hands in the back pockets of each other's jeans. They paused and locked lips. Justin looked away.
"Don't much like it," he admitted. "I'm red-blooded as the next one. Sometimes me and Missa... Well, none of that. It all happens soon enough, and I can wait."
"There are other girls, of course," Rabia pointed out. "Happy to have a roll in the hay, or whatever it's called these days. In the meantime, I mean... Sex with no strings? A hook-up and handshake?" Justin looked appalled.
"You mean doing it for relief, or the like?" "Oh, I'd never do that, Mrs. Lomax. I'm no cheater. Besides, now Missus back home, it won't be much longer. I've got my savings and something I'm doing on the side that's bringing in money."
"Have you a second job, then?" Rabia asked.
"Started my own business," Justin told her. "I don't like to say, because it's early yet, but it's doing the kind of work I always did best."
He held up his hands. They were nicked, calloused, and bore scars from burns that probably had occurred at the smithy.
These are my best tools. Long's I have these in working order, I can do just about anything.
Granny, it's such a treat to see you.
Rabia looked up to see that Missa had come into the pavilion and had purchased a flapjack. She kissed Rabia on the top of her head and joined them at their table, where she divided the flapjack in half and handed a share to Justin. She said,
"What a mad day. I've had to spend most of my time keeping 10-year-old boys away from the tallow vat. What about you, Justy? Any of the kids trying to stick their hands in the forge?"
"Only every one of them."
He had finished his cake and tea, and he glanced at a wristwatch that he took from his pocket. He rose, then took up the flapjack portion, wrapped it in a paper napkin, and said, "Half past, then," to Missa, in a message that she apparently understood. She said,
"Gran, you're going to see Mum and Dad, aren't you? Satchy as well? I could go home with you if you're still here at closing."
Rabia wanted to speak with Missa's mother alone, so she said,
"I'll be long gone by then, love. There's only so much Victoriana that a woman my age can take. You're better with Justin."
He looked pleased. He bent to Missa as if to kiss her, and she tilted her head to give him her cheek. He hesitated, then kissed her in the manner she wished. He nodded at Rabia in a farewell, and he left the pavilion. Not, Rabia noticed, without receiving the admiring glances of one girl at the till and two others in Victorian garb having their afternoon cups of tea. Missa appeared oblivious to this.
"What are you doing here?" she offered Rabia a fond smile. "I've come to see you." "Really?"
Missa used both hands to slide her sleek, bobbed hair behind her ears. It was, as always, shiny with health, which relieved Rabia, although she could not have said exactly why.
"Why have you come to see me? Not that it isn't a treat that you're here."
Missa added this last hastily, but Rabia could tell that she was suspicious. If her grandmother had driven up from Ludlow to see her particularly, there would be a reason, and chances were she wasn't going to like it.
"Justin seems as devoted as ever," Rabia noted.
Outside in the Victorian fairgrounds, a period roundabout began its slow spin, with calliope music accompanying it. Missa fingered her portion of the flapjack she'd bought, but she didn't take a bite.
"Hmm,"
was her reply.
"He was talking about his savings and what he intends to do with them," Rabia told her, "and about a business he's developing that involves his hands. It's hush-hush, apparently, but its purpose seems to involve buying a home. Well, it was always stupid for everyone to think he'd just stay with his mum and dad forever and be content as the one to take care of them. That's what they thought, you know. His dad was always saying, 'Just is our dumb one. He'll keep at home, so when we get dodgery, there he'll be.' Like Justin wouldn't be bothered by the label dumb one, like he didn't want a life of his own. Oh, decidedly he means to have a life. Do you know about this business he's got on the side? Has he told you about it?"
"Just that he's saving," Missa said. "I don't know anything about a business.
You might want to ask, or have a talk with him, or something."
Missa looked up, wide-eyed.
"Why? Don't be obtuse, Missa. You know very well he intends the two of you to marry, have children, walk hand in hand into your dotage. If that's what you want, fine. If that's not what you want, which is it? You were meant to be taking a break from each other when you first came to Ludlow. You told me as much last September. Where are you with each other now? I mean, according to you. I've already heard, according to Justin."
"We're not anywhere different, Gran," Missa replied. "We're just like we've always been."
Rabia eyed her.
"Really, Missa, you're not simple-minded."
Missa cocked her head to one side. She had a way of looking at one that made it easy to assume an offence had been given, but Rabia wasn't going to back away. This wasn't exactly the confrontation she'd intended to have with her granddaughter, but it would do for now.
"I wonder how he's going to react if you tell him that it isn't your intention to settle down in Ironbridge, have his babies, change their nappies, launder his clothing, and perhaps grow organic veggies in an allotment somewhere."
"You're not being very nice when you talk like that," Missa pointed out.
"Are you being nice? I don't know what you mean." "Rubbish! You know very well what I mean. Here you are, according to him, stressing virginity, no sex before and all the rest, which I assume means no hand, granny, no mouth, no back door, and... Oh, God, what is it?"
Missa's eyes had filled. Rabia saw she had gone too far.
"Oh, dear, I'm sorry,"
Rabia said. Missa made no reply, but she looked away.
"Missa, is there something that's happened between you and Justin that..." "I just want to be, Gran. Why can no one let me just be?"
"All right," Rabia said. "Forgive me, dear. I've not come all this way to do anything at all with regard to you and Justin."
"Why have you come, then?" "Because Ding and I had a talk today. After two visits from the Metropolitan Police, you must have known I'd have a word with the girl before I set them upon her like a pack of dogs.
Missa moved her gaze to Rabia, and her expression remained as open and frank as it always was.
What did she say?
I caught her by surprise. It would have been wise had you rung her directly, you and I.